Living in Canada, Helena, is that the equivalent of living like in an upstairs apartment above a meth lab now, with the US being the way we are? I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, it's a
Cold opening material, clearly.
say
That's all I'm looking for.
it's a attic with asbestos, man. Like it's they don't
Yeah, they got their own problems right now.
cut our own
You
I'll
think
take that back
Congress
then.
is dysfunctional?
And there go the international listeners. Bye.
Let us not waste more time.
Okay. I'm Charles Breton.
I'm Helena Epstein.
And I'm Chris Henson. Together we are
a Jew
and
a Gentile walking to
a bar
mitzvah.
Welcome, welcome. We're at episode 154 of
Boy.
This podcast where you come to find your theology, your cigars, whiskey, and F-bombs. And just remember that we are available wherever you found us, which is hopefully where you find your favorite podcasts. And we are very proud, a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah, to be part of the Wild Goose Goosecast Network, a network of faith-based podcasts discussing issues of inclusion and social justice. To learn more about the Wild Goose Festival, go to wildgoosefestival.org. And they are really picking up things to have more podcasting at the festival. A lot of good stuff is coming. And we do want to welcome in. We've got a special guest with us.
Repeat guest.
Well, I say friend of the podcast. You've heard him here before. Derek Weston. He co-hosts the Food and Faith podcast. He also hosts the Green Lectionary podcast and I think six other podcasts at the moment. But also he has a new book with co-author Anna Wolfenden called The Just Kitchen, Invitations to Sustainability, Cooking, Connection, and Celebration. So welcome, Derek. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I appreciate that. I am hopefully achieving friend of the podcast status.
You are.
Yeah,
for sure.
You smoke with us at Wild Goose. That.
Yes,
I did.
Got invited and got cigars. You're in, man.
All right, good.
Yeah, and we're still working on our Black Christian White Jew apology tour. coming to a hymnal near you. It's an inside
joke. Are the t-shirts
joke.
In the works?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You need one of those.
It's all it says is I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I just okay, now okay. Took me a minute to remember what the first
yeah.
Wild Goose. I apologize for all these people singing songs about the blood of Jesus.
Uh-huh. It's well, it goes both ways. It is
yes,
it is,
yes.
Me apologizing for the anti-Semitism of the hymnals, and it is Charles
apologizing
for the whiteness
for
of
the racism,
of everything else.
Everything else. Yeah,
just took all that on. And
yes,
just kind of minchy is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, somebody's got to do it, right?
Somebody
that's the first
to
step to the reconciliation.
There we go.
Somebody's
and the reckoning.
Start, yeah.
Yeah. And so Derek and I have stepped up. We're also stepping up. We want to shout out to some of the people we love who are not with us today because we had to make room for Derek. And since he hosts like about, 18 different podcasts at the moment. So, of course, Virgil Cane Whiskey. Four Saints Brewing Company that has really been coming through for us. They sponsored part of the Wild Goose Festival. They're going to be getting a lot more involved, so thank you to them. Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, which has opened their new location.
Oh,
they have a
I haven't
full
been
bar.
Yet.
We haven't been yet, but it looks fantastic.
Where's it at?
It's down in Innovation Quarter.
Innovation Quarter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's gonna be gorgeous.
They're getting really fancy Saturday smoking and jackets. Sunday night, you have to wear collared shirts. People are dressing to the nines. Coming, they've been posting pictures. It looks really awesome.
They have their own personal, with logo, smoking jackets available.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh. I had to make my own fancy. With logo Gaibetta. But smoking jackets, ooh. I don't know if I can afford that, though.
But it's not the only place we get cigars.
No. In fact, I've just added them to my list. Our good friend Pete Pike, formerly of the Pipe and Pint, has finally, what all of us have been hoping he'd do for a long time, has his own cigar shop. Pete Pike, great guy. It's Greensboro Cigar Company. He has an absolutely fantastic selection, as always. He curates a great selection of cigars and pipe tobaccos. Some things that I haven't seen in a while, brought in some new things. And his model and pricing is amazing. He's trying to hit the $8 to $10 cigar. So you can go in there and for less than $10 or $12, walk out with a fabulous cigar. I just recently was in there and he's added Tatuaje, but I had to pick up the Tatuaje Avion. Because, it's one of their special tats, and it was less than $15. It was like $11. This is a cigar that you're going to find anywhere from $15 to $20 in any other cigar shop.
Yeah, it's what I had last time at your place? The Hand of the Beast?
That
sounds like a weird sexual thing. Let's try.
Everything you say sounds that way to you. It was The Devil's Hand by Esteban Carrera.
Devil's Hand.
Yeah. And it's a Corojo Maduro. So one of the best wrappers you can have, Corojo, and they aged it like a Maduro. It is unbelievable. So it's amazing. So Pete, we're very happy for you.
Yes.
And highly recommend y'all stop in there.
And our own personal cigar company, our good friend.
Felix Azzeline.
There you go.
Yeah.
Setting it up for you there, Chief.
Yep. So Felix, shout out to you and Chag Sameach. This is the place where we normally would spend either nerding out or talking about cigars that we're smoking. But we're recording this at a time when the world's pretty much literally on fire right now, particularly the Middle East. And so I just wanted to take a moment and acknowledge that the conflict going on with Hamas and Israel. And you notice I didn't say the Palestinians and Israel, because it's really about Hamas. And just praying for the safety of everyone involved, Jewish, Israeli, Muslim, Palestinian, everybody in that region. It's going to be a while before that finds a resolution. And everyone's suffering because of it. So rather than spending time with our usual Mishigas, I just thought we'd just take a moment and acknowledge that. So with that said, that actually does leave us more time for talking with Derek about the Just Kitchen. So Derek, talk about the Just Kitchen.
that was a masterful segue.
We'll throw a commercial in there.
Yes,
you won't just follow Charles going, yes, the world is on fire.
Derek West.
I feel like Charles should have done that, but like in the voice of Kermit the Frog, like that's it.
And now for something completely different.
Four Saints Brewing Company. Four Saints pays homage to the patron saints of beer, St. Wenceslas, St. Nicholas, St. Luke, and St. Augustine of Hippo. They've become the most recognized patron saints for brewing and beer because of their contributions to and associations with the world's favorite sudsy beverage. Four Saints founders, Joel McCloskey and Andrew Deming, are carrying on the brewing tradition in hopes of future sainthood, or at least to make some really good beer. Four Saints Brewing Company, Asheboro, North Carolina.
And now.
We were saying earlier before we started recording, I'm really enjoying the book. I know it's been something you worked on for quite a while. It is not only an excellent book, but it is a passion project for you as well. And one of the things I like is I love in your introduction how you talk about that you and Anna read like every cookbook that was out there. And you're not cooks, you're not chefs, but food is central and important for a lot of different reasons. And that's what shaped this book. So I want to start with that. So how the two of you came to writing a non-cookbook with recipes that's about food and other things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good description of it. So Anna and I have been co-hosts on the Food and Faith podcast for about 3 years. She and our friend Sam started it in 2018. I was editing the podcast for a little bit, then came on as a co-host. And we have had really great conversations about all of the various ways that food intersects with our spiritual lives. Whether that's the justice of the ways that food is produced, who's gathering around the table. And as we were having this conversation, having these interviews, having all kinds of great conversations, and realizing that there was sort of a gap where we were talking about production, we were talking about what's happening at the table, but we weren't talking about the kitchen beyond here's a cookbook. And thinking about the fact that the kitchen can be a really central part to people's lives and people's homes, where kitchens can be places where a lot of healing takes place. It can also be as we've started talking about the book, also recognizing, and we try to touch on this in the book, that the kitchen can be a place where maybe growing up we didn't feel welcome. Maybe we didn't feel like we were even allowed in a kitchen of our homes. And so just recognizing that what we cook, who's doing the cooking, whether or not they enjoy cooking, the recipes that are being cooked, the occasions for which cooking is happening, all of those things have the opportunity to be a reflection of the things that we value, the things that are important to us, the people that are important to us, the stories that are either our personal stories or stories of our heritage. And that all of these things, these pieces of ourselves that make up who we are, can find a home in what we cook, and so the kitchen can in some ways be the heartbeat of our homes. So we decided that's what we wanted to write about.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a friend, and her mother always said that next time she builds a house, it will be nothing but a kitchen, because it doesn't matter what else is going on. The only place people want to be is in the kitchen. Well, one of the things that I really enjoyed is in the first chapter, you have what for me is a Mad Lib, where you have this script. What do you bring to your kitchen? Mm-hmm. And you have these blanks. So it says the first kitchen counter I remember is insert color material. In my home with all these blanks. And then each of you fill it out and tell your story. What I love about it is the invitation to the reader to join you.
Yeah.
So tell them, but again, just I like talking about where the ideas come from.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is such a novel thing that please tell us how you guys decided this. And because you talk about the first kitchen I remember an ingredient, the important person in your life and what mm-hmm. they cooked, being invited to do something in the kitchen, just all these different things. Go ahead and just, you know, how did this come about?
Yeah, so there's a couple pieces here. One is that we decided that we wanted people to be engaged, like not just read the book, but actually do a little bit of work. So there are throughout the book, there are participatory prayers and liturgies, and we try to keep them as we own the fact that we are Christians, but also try to make it as much of an interfaith or no faith invitation as possible, that values and justice aren't something that Christians have a monopoly on. In fact, we're often doing a pretty terrible job at those things. But we wanted this really to be an invitational kind of piece where people, where we can share a little bit of our kitchen histories and the ways the kitchens have shaped us, but we also want to leave space for reflection for people to think about, you know, what's a kitchen, whether it was a kitchen of my parents' home, the kitchen of a grandparents' home, kitchen even of a friend's home, you know, as we begin to have these conversations with people, recognizing that the kitchen that was formative for some folks isn't always the kitchen in the home they grew up in. It might be a friend's home, it might be an aunt's home, it might be a grandparent's home. So inviting people to think and do some reflection, do some remembering, do some just kind of allowing people to sit with a little bit of their own stories of how has the kitchen shaped them for better, for ill. You know, when I was sharing a little bit about the book a couple months ago, and I was sharing this piece from chapter one, and someone afterwards, you know, kind of pulled me aside and said, you know, the kitchen I grew up in, the kitchen, my parents' kitchen, it wasn't a very happy place. And so when you brought that up, I immediately went to a different kitchen. I went to my grandparents', you know, kitchen. And that was the place where I experienced love and acceptance. That was the place where I experienced the comfort of food. That was the place where I experienced that a space where I was actually welcome to participate. And so recognizing that, like, when we draw people into these places of reflection, that this can be complicated, and we really want to invite that complication. We really want to invite people to give that kind of nuance. Because as we state in the book, you know, part of, you know, when we, even as we were doing the interviews, so part of how we shaped the book was we kind of double dipped with our podcast. We took a lot of our interviews and we adapted them for the book. But as we were having the conversations to write the book, you know, people were either talking about sourcing or they were talking about gathering around the table. And so we would go, kind of a repeated refrain was, okay, yeah, but let's go back to the kitchen. And so we started to interrogate, why do people need to be drawn back to the kitchen? And recognizing that, for a lot of people, for a lot of women, you know, the kitchen has been sort of this place of a woman's place is a kitchen, and therefore there's sort of this oppressive power dynamic. For a lot of people of color, there has been this dynamic of cooking for other people, cooking for people with wealth, cooking for people, cooking for white people. And recognizing that there's always kind of been this power dynamic in the kitchen that makes cooking, unless you're completely free of all of those dynamics, can make cooking this chore and this real discomfort exists for a lot of people when they're talking about cooking because of the sense of these power dynamics. And so as we've started to explore all of these things, recognizing that people have really, really complicated issues around cooking, when you actually stop and reflect on them, it becomes a lot messier for people. And we wanted people to explore some of that messiness.
Well, I'm just curious if we can engage a little bit with it. Like, I'm wondering what everybody's mm-hmm. like, what's the first thing you remember being cooked? Like, I want to talk about it. Like, if we're going to talk about the kitchen, let's talk about the kitchen. Like, my curiosity's peaked around, like, Charles' experiences, Chris's experience, your experiences, Derek. Like,
yeah,
I'll go first. It's interesting to me because we're talking about food and faith. The first thing I remember being cooked in my life was in my grandparents' kitchen, my grandmother making salami and eggs, which is interesting for a few reasons. Salami and eggs is very Jewish, which I didn't realize until I was much older, but you don't do bacon and eggs, right? You do salami and eggs because salami is kosher. And I just assumed everyone made salami and eggs because it's delicious until one day I suggested it at a friend's house and they looked at me like I was crazy. Like, why would you eat it? And I was like, wait a minute, salami's beef. Like, no wonder. Also, my grandmother didn't cook. Like, that was all she cooked. Like, I grew up in a family where the men cooked. And I learned how to cook when my parents got divorced because I assumed my mother didn't know how to. Turns out I was wrong, but she was also more than happy to let me like take over and do that. So I learned how to cook in that context. But it was interesting. You're talking about this. And I was like, oh, my first memory of food is very contextualized within the faith tradition I was raised in. Like, so that was interesting. So it made me curious about Charles' experience and Chris.
Hey, my mom made it best leave it in the neighborhood. Take it or leave it. It was not a good thing. I mean, but I like the comment about we're drawn to the table, but not back to the kitchen. Because that was always, like, I can remember my grandmother, if we gathered and it was around a table and it was something special, it was usually if my grandmother was involved. But she was also a person trying to get everybody ready to go to church and then cooking and then coming back and finishing cooking. You know, and then I remember one day she finally said, like, I'm done. You know, her health was failing. She's like, we're going to go out and eat at a church. That was a big deal, you know, at that time and that age here in North Carolina, you didn't do that, but it was also a reflection of the fact that she was carrying the lion's share or whatever of the responsibilities. You know, she enjoyed feeding her family, but there was more to it than that. It's nice to like, oh, let's just talk about the table we gathered around, but there's something misleading about that I'm glad Derek pulled the focus to no, let's get away from that, come back to
the work that happens.
My mother did the cooking indoors, my father did the cooking outdoors, as is common. But one of the main things that I remember is when my mother wasn't working anymore, she decided that, Shabbat was always the big thing, and there was always a huge pot of matzo ball soup. But my mother wanted to make her own challah, and she also wanted to bake bread. And the reason she wanted to bake bread was she felt it was important for children to grow up in a house with the smell of bread baking. You know, so Tuesdays was bread baking day, when she'd make several loaves of a variety of bread for the week. And I think it's one of the reasons why bread is like one of my weaknesses. I could live, just give me a loaf of bread and a pound of butter and I'm happy. You don't have to cook anything else.
It's Jesus didn't say take, eat, this is my broccoli of
This is not the broccoli of life. No.
Yeah, no. No. So
just gonna leave that out there.
Yeah. So, you know, she was very intentional about that. And also that we were all very welcome in the kitchen. And I think also it's kind of a Jewish thing as well, because food is incredibly central to every single holiday. And that even for a lot of families, cooking is more of a generational thing. So my mother never chased us out of the kitchen. Get out, I'm trying to, you know, if we're in there, then she gave us something to do, you know, and help. But, you know, food was always important, particularly Shabbat dinners. And, you know, we're a family of six, there's four kids. And my parents would encourage us to invite friends for Shabbat dinner. So any Friday night, there'd be anywhere from 8 to 15 people around the table.
Wow.
And 13 of them were teenagers. It was a lot of work for my mom, but she loved it. Because it was so important and all the connections. So yeah, I have very good memories. But there's also something about Jewish cooking, and also in the way that my parents were raised. And if you look at a lot of Jewish recipes, especially European Jews, cooking comes from a place of scarcity. So you have recipes that don't have a lot of ingredients or have very inexpensive, a lot of beans, a lot of rice, a lot of vegetables in things. So, you know, everybody associates chicken with Shabbat dinner. That's because a lot of times you didn't have meat for the rest of the week. Mm-hmm. You know, so even though we were quite comfortable economically, a lot of the food, especially for my father, would hearken to things that his mother would make on a shoestring. And the joke that we had about my mother's mother, or grandmother, was she was such a magician in the kitchen that if she had at least a couple of ounces of flour and an apple, she could make you two or three apple pies. You know, that she knew she could stretch it, you know. And my parents talked about that at the dinner table, you know. If we had things that my parents couldn't have afforded to have when they were kids, they would say, you know, you really know that you're lucky that you can have this, you know, whatever the food it was. So you had that dynamic of the kitchen and the table was this joyous family place, but there was always the recognition that we are privileged to be able to do this.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the chords that struck me, like we were talking about the book. I love the liturgy at the end of each chapter. I love the, you know, what is, how did you put it? What is your wish for hope that you have at the beginning of each chapter? You know, starting that way, I think that's one of the reasons that it really resonates with me. You know, before you get into, oh, and here's a recipe news for you. Let's talk about hope. What are you hoping for? What is, you know, I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, thank you. And like, just even just right here in the four of us, I mean, how many stories and relationships and connections were touched on just from the four of us talking about thinking of our kitchen memories. And I think that's the kind of stuff that we tried to bring out in the book. These are the kinds of things that we tried to mine for the book. And I you know, Charles, particular, as you were talking about, you know, sort of the historical connections that so many of our dishes have to times of struggle and times of lack and times of need. Like, that is the story of Jewish food. That is the story of African-American soul food. That is the story of a lot of of traditional cultural foods, which ironically now you, every one of those things that I've mentioned now have high-end versions, but, where you can go to a restaurant and spend an arm and a leg for what was once peasant food, right?
Yeah.
But I think that
my mom always talks about chicken wings that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You
know, chicken wings were like, nobody bought chicken wings. It was crazy to eat a chicken wing. And now you could spend, you know, $50 on two or three different varieties of chicken wings.
Yeah. Or heart of palm.
Yeah.
Heart of palm.
Yeah. That was, you know, in the South, especially in South Florida, where you had palmetto palms. South Florida.
Wait.
No. I'm talking when it was, in really was, where, you go out into the palmetto scrub because you got nothing else, and you cut out a heart of palm, and that's a dinner. And now you would spend, you know, $100 at a fancy restaurant to get heart of palm.
like anything with grits. Like that's
anything with grits.
Anything with grits.
Yeah.
People think, oh, this is brunch food. I'm like, no, this is broke ass food right here.
Yeah, and I don't remember what it was, but there's one food that my father refused to eat because he's like, I'm not poor anymore.
Potted meat.
Yeah, it wasn't that.
Definitely not kosher.
Not that. Yeah. I can't remember what it was, but because my mother wouldn't make it. So she said, no, we're not. We asked about it sometime. I don't even remember what it was now. But to him, that was the reminder of growing up like that. And, you know, now he was a professional. He was successful, had this family. It's like, no, I can afford not to eat this anymore.
Yep.
Yeah. And now you got people going out, whatever it was, probably paying 20 times what it costs to eat. Yeah.
But again, just kind of think about that, like how food speaks to status, food speaks to class, food speaks to a journey from not having to having, and like all of these different kinds of things. I think we underestimate, until we actually sit and investigate it, we underestimate the role that food plays in shaping and marking identity. And that's what, I mean, that's what a lot of our work on the Food and Faith podcast is. And that's what a lot of our work in this book was, is just recognizing that, like, we put so much of ourselves, whether we know it or not, whether we're conscious of it or not, we put so much of ourselves into our food. And our food says so much about who we are, where we are, what we value, what we think about in life. And I just, you know, I mean, I clearly, like, I love having these kinds of conversations, because I think it becomes such a revelation for people that, like, wow, I haven't thought about how much is invested in this idea of what I'm eating and what it says about me. So
you think that's changed, though? I'm just hearing those stories, I'm kind of like, I'm just aware that for many people, their kitchen, or what qualifies as their kitchen, is fast food joint.
Yep.
Have somebody that's totally detached.
Yep.
And you're, you know, there's all kinds of areas for exploration, but
well,
when we talk about this stuff, I keep feeling like, yeah, that's something old people can talk about, and old people being like 40 something or 30 something.
Okay. Thank you.
So us.
So I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the three of you.
It wilds me when people don't know how to
cook. I'm older
than
that.
So many people that do not know how to cook. Like,
yeah.
Right.
I don't get, and like, we were poor girl. Like, we had to cook. It wasn't, we did not go out. We didn't have the money to go out. Like,
I think, you know, to both of those points, I think there's a couple things. One is that, there's a couple things, right? One is that we spend less time cooking than any point. Like, we are, the amount that Americans spend in the kitchen is the least amount of any point in history. There was a brief spike during the pandemic. where like we were all like, oh no, we better learn how to make things just in case we have to. And then like that spike took a dramatic like nosedive, not even at the end of the pandemic, but like people had a couple of months where they were like, oh yeah, I'm gonna cook, here's my sourdough starter. And then like we're like, no, I'm done. And then what we saw was DoorDash and Uber Eats went through the roof, and people were like, yeah, that's about enough of that. And even you know, so that's, I mean, that's also a part of writing this book, is that I think that one of the things that we have found, one of the things the research has found, is that we eat better when we cook. When we are cooking for ourselves, yeah. Michael Pollan says it well, in his talking about his book In Defense of Food. What we have done is outsource cooking to big corporations. And when they do that, they put more sugar, more fat, and more salt into the foods. Mm-hmm. And when we cook for ourselves, generally speaking, we tend to make things healthier than what a corporation, any of the corporations who are cooking for us, tend to do. And so this is also a little bit about regaining some health and regaining some relationship to food, so that our relationship to food isn't just a fast food relationship, and even not just a DoorDash Uber Eats relationship, but like we can actually have a relationship with food where we can think a little bit more about where food comes from. One of the people whose work has been pretty influential for me has been, two of people actually, Norman Wirzba, in writing about Wendell Berry, talks about how food is our most intimate connection to creation, how it's our most intimate connection to the created world. And I thought about that, and I thought about how many foods that I eat that I can't actually like draw the line back to the created world. And I'm like, I don't know how many steps are between Doritos and nature. Like it's probably too many. A
couple of them. Yeah. There's two or three, I think.
There's probably too many steps between nature and Doritos. And so like thinking about that, like if that is the case, and I'm pretty sure it is, like that's probably not a good thing. And probably Doritos shouldn't be the staple for me that they sometimes are at various points in my life. But when we're eating on our best, we can that distance between nature and the food that we're eating becomes a little shorter. So yeah, just kind of thinking about that, you know, rediscovering cooking not just as an art and as a craft and as a sense of storytelling, but also as a means of health, as a means of healing, and as a means of you know, in the midst of a climate crisis, as the means of thinking about our planet and thinking about creation, that all of those things can kind of be reflected in our cooking.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Ooh. Great.
Yeah. So you have a wonderful family.
I do.
So how often are you in the kitchen with the kids cooking and teaching them to cook?
Not as much as I'd like to be. But it's happening more often, which is good.
Yeah.
You know, one was because they're I'm starting
yeah,
to
yeah, I can say they're at the ages now where spending time with mom and dad is not the top of their list.
Where I trust them a little bit more. So that's part of it. Oh, and just generally like some curiosity has begun to, you know, part of what I've always been careful about is like not forcing things that I care about on the kids, but kind of like creating spaces where where spaces of curiosity can emerge. Because you know the best way to get kids to rebel against something is to tell them that it's important to you. But when you know my son has begun to ask questions about you know my baking bread and my we have this little tiny pizza oven, and he's begun to ask questions about cooking things and like making pizzas in the pizza oven, and there's a fascination that they've started to connect the dots between I'm a gardener and like hey guys, the pizza sauce or the spaghetti sauce, you know, that came from tomatoes that I grew. And then all of a sudden, like you can see the equations and the numbers and calculations going off in their heads going, wait a minute, tomato sauce, pizza, wait a minute. food is coming from this thing that he does outside. And so being able to like help them connect some of those dots and even beginning to ask, you know, questions, you know, at the beginning of garden season of like, okay, what can I grow that you will eat? Mm-hmm. And asking those sorts of questions, and then, you know, asking them questions about preparation and things like that. It's not happening as much as I want, but it's happening more. And I figure like if I'm just real patient about it and just like don't turn into an overbearing jackass about it, you know, it will come. It's coming, and it's coming more and more. So I'm just don't be a jerk. Is the thing I said to myself. Oh, good.
Yeah. Cause I know, cause your kids are at those ages there. But yeah. You know, I humorously say putting on you on the spot, just knowing though that that those are will become really good memories for them.
Yeah.
And that, you know, giving them those opportunities, that is a nice thing. So, you know, I started with my boys. My oldest started out as doing prep, and then he made it to sous chef. Nice. And now he's chef de cuisine. Because I can just cut him loose in the kitchen now. And my youngest is a baker now.
Hey,
he was never into cooking, but he loves baking. And so, and again, you know, but then, you know, I didn't force him in. I said, hey, you know, want to come help me? You know, and some, you know, and for a while, I was like, oh, you know. But yeah, it's good when you bring him in. And it, and I know, because your family's so awesome. I figured that they would be, that at least some of them would find a way to be in the kitchen with you.
They're finding their way, and they're starting to enjoy it more. And actually a couple of weeks ago I was traveling for work, and Shannon told me that she did kind of make them cook. which I found very humorous, but they rose to the occasion too. Mm-hmm. And like the fact of the matter is, you know, like our oldest will start to ask questions about like, can I make dinner, you know, this week? And then we'll be like, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And like, all right, what are you going to make? But you know, it's coming along, and it'll be fun to see how it develops. And again, they're kind of finding it on their own, which is fun.
The next thing, and maybe we can follow with Helena's prompt of making this more of a discussion with all of us. So I love in your the text in the book, each chapter has its own theme of a kitchen as a place of. And some of the things we've talked about, like community and interaction, keeper of stories and history. But this I like chapter 4. And not just because it's black bean soup, which I love, is the recipe. But that chapter is the kitchen as a place of transformation. So let's take that. How has the kitchen been transformative for us? To all of us. So who wants to go?
I'm just thinking how I'd want to answer that. I don't, because the kitchen is like in a lot of ways probably where I'm my most creative. Like I don't know, I don't necessarily think of it as transformative, but it's a creative space for me, right? Like I love, I call it cooking in my head. Like I'll cook in my head all day long, and then I get in the kitchen and like I make it happen, and it's awesome because 98 times out of 100, I get it right. Like I'm pretty good at not screwing up in the kitchen. So like it's but it's fun for me to like tweak, you know, like I'll tweak flavors in my head and imagine things. So to me, like transformation's not, that's actually kind of, I think of it as a very imaginative and very like creative space to be in. And I'm not any good at cooking the same thing twice though. Like I'm not that girl, but, and I guess like if I'm, I have like, it's interesting you brought up baking. Baking's where I think I finally started to learn a little bit of discipline in the kitchen, where, because you can't just do whatever you want to when you bake. Like I'm starting to get enough of the, like it's been, I started baking during the pandemic. That was my, like I've cooked since I was 11, but I'd never learned to bake and no one in my family bakes. So I put my nose to the grindstone with that. And I finally have enough of the fundamentals that like I'll step, like this weekend I made blondies, but instead of using, you know, all white chocolate chips, I added butterscotch chips and put in maple like extract to make like a kind of like the perfect fall blondie, right? Like I went outside, but like I would never tweak butter, I would never tweak flour. Like I'm not confident enough for any of that yet. So
when should we expect these to arrive? Yeah, and clear customs.
They're in the mail.
Okay.
Maybe accompanied by cigars. I made them for a friend that needed them for a bake sale, and they won number one in the bake sale. I was very proud of myself. Wow. They were there.
Nice.
Yeah, I was like, hell yeah, I did. So for me, that transformation, I guess, has just been about kind of learning, and then like learning. It's about learning. The kitchen is a place for me to learn and to explore and try new things, but without any fear of failure, like I have in other places in my life.
One of the things that we talk about in the book, my friend Jason is a filmmaker, he's an artist, and we talk about the fact that, like, you know, caramelizing, and he talks about the fact that, like, caramelizing onions is, like, magical. You know, it's this weird transformation that, like, you add heat to onions and all of a sudden they become this kind of, like, completely different substance. And that kinds of, you know, one of the things in thinking about the transformation piece is thinking about awe and like how we don't often have enough spaces of awe and wonder, particularly in a place where we have the, you know, so many routine and chore-like things that happen in the kitchen. But like a lot of what happens when we cook is pretty magical. Like it's pretty magical when bread rises. Like it's pretty magical when, you know, you cook something to a perfect temperature or perfect consistency, and like I think that should create a little bit of awe. And I think
you know what is super awesome is when you're cooking like a big meal and you get everything out at the same time.
Yes.
That is magical.
Yes.
Yes. No, that's sorcery.
You feel like a fucking wizard.
That's borderline witchcraft.
Right. But more than magic. Hashtag. Yeah, more than magic. I love the analogies of cooking as alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're taking things and transforming them into different matter. You know, they become different elements. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. Actually, my transformation story is not mine. This is my all-time favorite student essay. And I have her permission, even though she wrote this essay 30 years ago, from the student to tell the story. The essay assignment was to write a process. And usually when I teach students to write process, we look at recipes and cooking because it's a very clear step-by-step process. But I always say, but, you know, why are you telling us this recipe? What's the significance of this food? Because I want them to explore deeper. Well, this young lady wrote this essay on how to make a pot of coffee. And the process was put coffee filter in the coffee pot, add coffee, add water, press on. Right? That was the process. Because her essay was about whenever her family gathered for big family occasions, the women did all the cooking and the men did all the cleaning. And while the men were cleaning, all the women would sit at the kitchen table having coffee and they would talk. And two important life cycle events happened to her. One was when her mother asked her to make the coffee. So like, wow, I'm making the coffee. But the big one was the occasion where she had made the coffee, she served her mother, her grandmother, and all her aunts, and was going to go out to be with the other children. And her grandmother stopped her and said, no, come sit at the table. Because that was the day she knew she was a woman.
Wow.
Was that transformation. And that story, it was a beautifully written essay. I use it as an example to my students about, yeah, you're writing about a recipe, but you're writing about more than food.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why her process was, yeah, set up the coffee pot and turn it on. You know, so that she had the space to tell this beautiful story of the day that her grandmother saw her as one of the women of the family and not one of the children. And
that's a cool story.
Yeah. And I love cool story. Yeah. I mean, I still get choked up when I think about it because, you know, it is. But that's the power. And I, you know, that's a place where, you know, kitchens are places of transformation. You know, when you get a little bit more responsibility, right? That time that, oh, now I can use a knife. Now I can, you know, becoming that different person is a very real thing in kitchens because of, you know, there's sharp objects and hot things.
You know? Yeah.
So,
it's dangerous in there.
Yeah. Yeah. But you talk about baking. Evan, my youngest, he cooks, and he cooks okay, but he was never interested in learning to cook with me, but baking, because baking is exact. Mm. And he couldn't deal with cooking not being exact. But for him, it's the, you know, he finds the peace in the measuring everything. Make sure he has the right proportions, and, you know, he's the person who bakes the cakes for his friends' group's birthdays. He's the one who does that. And, you know, as a kid, he's 26, on the spectrum, you know, baking is his way of, I mean, talk about transformation.
Yeah.
You know, so it's pretty awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. Let's talk liturgy, because you have some really awesome ones, and they're from all kinds of different places. Some you and Anna wrote, some you have attributed to other. What went into some of your decisions on that? Because some of them are just amazing. One of my favorites is the last one, because I just, when I saw the title, which is a liturgy for compost.
Oh.
Before the bowl flows over with onion peels or gives home to the fruit flies, before the mold grows green, I lift thee from the kitchen table and carry you out to the heap of hot soil. I lift you toward the heavens before I release you. You are an offering. May you do well, bless this dirt, and become life once more. From Lydia Wiley Kellerman. I just, when I saw the title, I said, I have to read that. That is awesome. So,
that is awesome.
Yeah, so... You know, what's one of your favorites? Where did you pull these from? Well, amazing little pieces of thought.
So Anna wrote quite a few of them. Anna wrote, I want to say, almost all of them, with a couple of exceptions, like the one that you just read, and where it wasn't our intent. that Anna write as many of them. In fact, we were trying to find ones that we could borrow. But what ended up happening was, for anyone who has ever written a book, one of the things that ends up being an obstacle is getting permission from other people who have written stuff to use their stuff. And so that actually became a kind of creative process of like giving Anna some freedom to do some writing. And so, you know, one of the ones that I really like in the chapter on mutuality, because we write a lot about so much of the book is about cooking in our home kitchens, but we also wanted to talk a little bit about cooking in kitchens like faith community kitchens when we are serving others, particularly those who don't have as much as we have. And so thinking about how that can be a really dehumanizing, demoralizing process, and really wanting us to do better as communities of faith when we are serving people who are in need. And so a lot of what that chapter is about. And so Anna wrote this liturgy called All Are Welcome Here. And it says, when we say all are welcome, we like to think we know what that means, but maybe it's a challenge, a question to always be asking. What is welcome to you, to me? What does welcome taste like? How does it feel? And how do we need to change to make it real? All are welcome as an invitation to lower the counters and bring out more baking dishes, to learn new recipes and change our language, to open ourselves up to the wholeness of other human beings, and to welcome all of ourselves as well. And it's beautifully written, and I think it actually kind of encapsulates that chapter really well. That when we say all are welcome in a lot of different spheres of the kind of faith community life, what do we really mean, and are we really willing to do the things that make all welcome? You know, it was one of those things where we were thinking about the utility of this book and thinking about, you know, yes, we want it to kind of like, you know, get coffee stains on it and be in people's kitchens and those sorts of things. But we want people to be able to open it, whether they're cooking at home for their families, if they're cooking by themselves, or if they're cooking in a space like a church kitchen, and thinking about what are the ways that we bless this space? What are the opportunities to bless this space? We wanted that to be a part of the utility of the book.
Well, it is. That, like I said, I enjoy it because, you know, you're sharing wonderful stories. Either you or Anna or the people you've interviewed, there's nice recipes, but there's also these things that I want to say that they're thoughtful. There's thoughtfulness. It's provocative, but it's more than that. It's both a think about these things, but also a very gentle challenge to do better.
Yeah,
you know, in everything that's in here, and like I said, my family, we are enjoying reading it. As soon as everyone's finished, we're going to be using a lot of these recipes.
Thank you.
And I may probably going to use this. We do a monthly theology philosophy chat group called Drinking Religiously. I'm going to use some of these things.
Excellent.
About that, because it's just one of our.
And stories. there is a drink recipe in there. So.
Oh, good. Derek, thank you. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
On your 57 podcasts that you're hosting.
He's everywhere, man.
He's everywhere, I know. And if you've made it through this far listening to this podcast, congratulations. And you're probably the only one who's noticed that number has increased each time I've said it. Because it just seems like we're at Wild Goose this past summer. And I think there was like four podcast entries, and Derek was on all four of those.
Like all of
them. There's more than four, but there were four that Derek
He basically just lived in the podcast tent.
I kind of lived in the podcast tent that weekend. So, which actually worked out.
Charles.
Really. Yeah. It worked out well because it was really good podcasts this year.
They were.
It was exciting. I'm looking forward to this summer one. So as always, we're going to end with words of wisdom that are chosen totally at random, that have no bearing on anything that we've talked about in this episode. I was very tempted to go with John Lennon, since the day that we were recording this would have been his 83rd birthday. But I said, no, that's too obvious. So instead, I'm going with Oscar Wilde.
Ah,
always okay. A good choice. And Oscar Wilde famously quipped, "After a good dinner, one can forgive anybody, even one's relations."
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
I'm Helena Epstein, and I'm still the ampersand of reason.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah. Wishing I could change
the things that I... Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. Give back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from your mistakes, you'll get another chance at that.